So, Mr. Campbell, before we took a break, you were telling me that beginning in mid-06, Countrywide started to re-examine its investment strategy. Can you tell me what kind of changes it made to its investment strategy in the second half of 06 and forward, and why?
We decided to slow down the growth of the bank. We decided to credit enhance some of our existing portfolio, particularly the pay option portfolio. We decided to sell all of our pay option production into the secondary market, as opposed to retaining some of it in the bank. Although we didn't preclude the bank from necessarily from going out and acquiring pay options on their own, but that had some caveats as well, and we. Those are some of the things that come to mind. There's many things we did. Those are some of the notable things that come to mind.
Okay. And I'll tell you, for example, I think in every earnings call in 07, as you may recall, you know, the company was reporting increasing charges related to the decline in the housing market and the deterioration of the loan portfolio and the investment portfolio. And in every one of those calls, I don't know if it was you or Mr. Mazzillo or Mr. Curlin or Mr. McMurray, but there's always statements that, and we're tightening our underwriting guidelines. How were the underwriting guidelines tightened from mid-06 forward?
Well, I think in the bank, in the bank, there were, you know, a variety of things that we did. We, you know, increased start rates on the riskier products and the pay option arms. We instituted some, I'm not sure when the timelines, we instituted some geographic filters that you know, precluded us from originating, for example, investor loans in certain markets or condo loans in other markets, you know, specifics of which I don't recall. But that's with respect to the to the pay option loans in the bank. I don't know what we would have done in terms of scorecards and so forth, minimum scores, but the bank had a scoring system for loans that they would invest in, and you know, they continued to make changes there. I would say most of the tightening came in 07, and in 2007, that was a period where there was significant retraction in guidelines. Starting in the first quarter of 2007, you know, with the subprime loans, again, not something applicable to the bank, and for the most part, you know, in the latter half of the year with respect to all other loans.
And how come?
Well, you know, performance results that we in the industry looked at pointed to the need for tightening. Investor demand for some of these products changed, and that, you know, resulted in the need for tightening. And, you know, notably, what was happening was you know, the housing market was cooling drastically, and that necessitated some adjustments.
I've seen the numbers on the performance of the loans. How was investor demand changing in 2006, 2007?
Well, in the first quarter of 2006, their investor demand materially, you know, was materially impacted for subprime loans and subprime securities, which caused significant tightening in the subprime market. And in fact, I recall that in the in our first quarter conference call, you know, we showed a slide of the profile of our production, you know, with respect to certain risk attributes, in the fourth quarter of 06 and compared that to the profile, expected profile of our production after the tightening. And so the result was materially different, you know, profile of subprime loans and a materially lesser volume of such loans as a result. And so that was, it was pretty drastic. After, in the second half of 2007, there was...
So, by the way, you had said earlier the first half of 06. Did you mean the first half of 07 when you talked about
I meant the first half of 07.
And in fact, I think you said the first quarter of 06.
You
meant 1Q07, right?
I'm sorry. I meant the first quarter of 07 with respect to the subprime market. As it relates to the rest of the market, after August of 07, there was virtually no investor demand for any mortgage securities other than Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac securities, such that all such loans that were, you know, previously originated, and guidelines, you know, applicable to loans that were originated, you know, they were originated on the basis, on the premise that there was investor demand, and there wasn't investor demand for those loans. And so that was what precipitated, you know, the massive tightening and retraction of guidelines in the second half of 07.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to come back to 07 in a minute, and we'll get to the liquidity issues that occurred. But before I get there, I want to ask you how did it change at all when the guidelines started to expand after 2003? How did that impact the amount of loans that were being sold or securitized by the GSEs as opposed to the street? Did that change over time?
I think if you're asking me what the GSE share of the market was, or, you know, the percent of how the market changed in terms of the percent of originations which were a conventional conforming, eligible for the standard for delivery under the standard GSE programs, that dropped dramatically from 03 to 06. I think it dropped from, their share was in the 60s, and it dropped to some number in the 30s or low 40s.
And just so I'm understanding that, Cook, you mean the GSE share of the origination market?
Yes.
Okay. And in terms of Fannie's and Freddie's guidelines, did they change as the guidelines expanded post 2003?
I believe. Well, I think, and I'm not an expert on this, but I believe that their standard guidelines, you know, perhaps either didn't change or didn't change much, but recognizing that the non-traditional market was growing and eating into their historical conforming market, I believe they were the investor on a negotiated basis for subprime loans and non-traditional loans that weren't part of their standard guidelines. And their appetite and desire to invest in those products, you know, in part, you know, like other investors, you know, that had a desire and appetite to invest in those products, you know, supported the non-traditional market.
Okay. What was your role in terms of dealing with the GSEs when you were at Countrywide?
I really didn't deal with them at all, or, you know, virtually at all, until I became president. And so my my understanding, and that which I conveyed, was just kind of a general perception. But there are others, like you said, Kevin Bartlett or John McMurray, that would be much more conversant in exactly what they bought and how they bought it and what was in their guidelines versus negotiating and so forth.
How did your role change once you became president in terms of dealing with the GSEs?
Well, you know, I became president going into my first full quarter as president was the fourth quarter of 2006.
So timing's everything.
Yeah, timing's everything. Obviously, as president, all of these areas reported up to me where they previously didn't. The notable change, you know, after I became president was that the chief investment area and the risk area reported to me. And so I would have had more visibility to, you know, matters related to the GSEs and investments and so forth and risk.
Right. And what were the issues with the GSEs, if any?
Well, frankly, you know, initially there was very little, you know, that crossed my radar screen with respect to the GSEs. I more so got involved with them, you know, once the crisis in the summer of 07, you know, befell us. And then, you know, the GSEs were a major counterparty, you know, that we had to talk to and coordinate, you know, with, given all the changes, you know, that were occurring countrywide. And you know, I was involved in those discussions with them, as I was with all of our, you know, other, you know, constituents.
Mm-hmm. And we'll get to the summer of 07. And in a second. Do you ever have any discussions with GSEs about their performance of the loans that they were purchasing, and in particular the whole issue of buybacks on reps and warranties?
No, I don't recall having any conversation with them on buybacks. But I would have, you know, been made aware of whatever the trends were with respect to you know, repurchase requests.
Okay, and understand you didn't have, you don't recall discussions with the folks at Fannie or Freddie. I mean, do you recall that being an issue at all? The issue of, was Fannie or Freddie saying, we got problems with the loan, you need to buy back a lot more?
My recollection with respect to buybacks is that throughout 2006, you know, there was a population of loans that that were the subject of buyback discussions, and progress was being made, and, you know, negotiation of a resolution to those buybacks, and I was periodically updated, but there wasn't you know, something that was alarming or material to the company, or you know, where I was concerned about buybacks in 2006.
Okay. So take me through, if you can, let's move to the 2007 and the liquidity problems that came to a head in August. And in particular, because I believe at some point during the July 24th, 2007, second quarter 2007 conference call, and I clearly didn't mark it well enough in my notes, but here we go. Mr. Mazzillo said, we're certainly not going to have any issues funding the company, which unfortunately turned out not to be the case.
When did he say that?
July 24th, 2Q07 earnings conference call, and then I think it's August 14, 15, 16 is when the 8K comes out and when the analyst report comes out and you guys draw on the lines. Take me through what happened.
Yeah, so I think that, I'll tell you from my perspective, I think that having just come out of the first quarter where the subprime market was, you know, materially disrupted, and the result, you know, was this material guideline retraction in you know, subprime loans, and the result of which is significantly fewer subprime loans are going to be made going forward. My view was that, you know, that the kind of the issue, this significant disruption in the secondary markets, was kind of isolated to subprime, and that while we expected you know, delinquencies to go up and credit costs to increase on prime loans and the rest of the market, as we conveyed, you know, and we talked to investors and earnings calls and the like, we didn't see any significant, you know, alarm or disruption or anything that would have, where we would have been clued in to what happened in August in the first week or the first 2 weeks of August of 07, where there was a complete shutdown in the secondary markets. That was a disruption that I know, speaking for myself, and you know, nobody ever conveyed to me a view otherwise, that was completely not anticipatable or just beyond my imagination that something like that could have occurred.
So I believe in the third quarter 07 conference call, and I probably even have some notes on it, actually I think it was you that described what happened in August, and you mentioned that in the negative analyst report contributed to deposit outflow, that you know, the company was unable to sell, I think, about a $12 billion pipeline full of loans. And, of course, that had liquidity issues. So you drew on the lines after unsuccessful negotiations with the bank. Clearly, I'm paraphrasing. In the earnings release, it was stated that it took like $1 billion hit and then transferred that pipeline into a held for investment portfolio. So how much of that portfolio that couldn't be sold was subprime, or was it mostly prime?
Well, after August of, you know, of 07, virtually no loans that were not Fannie Freddie conforming loans could be sold. Mm-hmm. So the entirety of our non-conforming pipeline and inventory, which had not been sold forward, I mean, it was a much bigger number than $12 billion, but, you know, we tended to put on forward sales. And so the entirety of anything that was non-conforming and had not already been sold forward before the crisis hit was now not saleable. Of that non-conforming inventory of loans we had that were unsaleable, some amount were subprime loans. I believe it was a minority of that amount, but it was all, you know, it was mostly prime. But I don't recall the specific mix.
And did you have any conversations with the secondary market about why no one was buying?
Well, we would receive input. I mean, people were talking, you know, communicating with the street, with investors, and so. You know, there was input as to what was going on, and I think it was just, you know, fear and uncertainty, and you know, investors tend to participate in a market when there's, you know, stability and when there's, you know, not a high degree of uncertainty. And And at that point in time, everybody was fearful that if they bought, even though they might like the underlying assets, you know, the prices were cheap enough for them to buy, they didn't know that, you know, the prices would slide further tomorrow, and, you know, a lot of these investors would have to mark to market, and there were reasons like that, you know, that pretty much caused the entire system to freeze up.
Mm-hmm. And any opinions on just why the system was freezing up in August of 07 and people had such fear and uncertainty about sliding prices?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things precipitated it. You know, again, in retrospect, that I've heard, you know, from commentary, but you know, the rating agencies announced that they were going to downgrade a lot of securities, and then rating agencies announced that they were going to change the way in which they were going to rate, you know, non-agency securities. But yet the market, you know, didn't have visibility as to exactly what they would do and how they would change their ratings, such that to the extent that there was the prospect of a change in the rating agency view of securities that would impact something that somebody buys today, you know, with the view that could be that the rating agency might downgrade it because of a change in approach that we don't know, was a big factor. The other big factor was that was the fear that there would be a lot of supply coming on the market, because to the extent prices had already dropped, there was a fear that holders of these securities, you know, might be forced for one reason or another to just, you know, get out of them, causing, you know, supply to come on the market, which would cause, you know, prices to drop later on, and that would cause pause with investors. And then there was, you know, concern over credit performance. You know, how what's going to happen with housing? How bad will it be? You know, how will these loans perform? And so there was significant environmental uncertainty as people were now, you know, they saw the period over period delinquency growth, you know, was continuing at a higher rate, and they saw, you know, signs of more stress in the housing market, and that had an implication of credit. And so to the convergence of all of these uncertainties caused investors to freeze and cease buying. And, you know, we were hopeful that that would be a temporary condition and that, you know, it would change because it looked as if, you know, on a fundamental basis, prices were too cheap. You know, nobody really knew.
So on the other side, were you involved in any of the negotiations with either the repo investors or the commercial paper investors or the medium-term note investors that didn't want to roll and that ultimately caused the bank to draw down the $11.5
billion? I was certainly very aware, you know, and involved. I was in the middle of as the president of the company, of the crisis, and so as these, you know, things were occurring. I mean, it was a you know, very, very significant crisis for Countrywide. I mean, if you can imagine, it was the company's lifeline that was being, you know, materially disrupted, both with respect to the way we funded our originations, you know, on the front end, you know, in terms of how we borrowed money, you know, from commercial paper investors, and how we sold our loans on the back end. And so I certainly was right in the middle of all that.
So what were the repo, commercial paper, and medium-term note investors telling you folks in terms of we don't want the exposure anymore, we don't want to roll the repos, we're not going to renew the commercial paper, et cetera?
I think it was a catch-all. I mean, it was a matter of we don't want anything that has the name mortgage on it, and so, you know, a lot of these investors, you know, either, you know, just said, look, with so much going on, with so much uncertainty, you know, we're just not going to invest in any commercial paper that supports a mortgage, such as our, you know, a lot of our commercial paper was, you know, is what was called, you know, asset-backed commercial paper. It was supported, mm-hmm. you know, with mortgages, and so not just with respect to Countrywide, but nobody wanted to understand what the quality of the mortgages, you know, were that underlying that. They just left the market, mm-hmm. and then that, you know, that expanded into an aversion to financing any institution with a mortgage, residential mortgage focus. And so it was a snowball that we picked up steam very, very quickly and very fast and grew in a very short period of time. And that's what we contended with. And if you read that third quarter earnings transcript, you know, I tried to encapsulate, you know, mm-hmm. Exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any conversations with any specific creditors?
Only our bank group would be the only creditors that I would have spoken with.
Okay, and who were those creditors?
So,
and what were they saying?
So our bank group, which is a consortium of banks that provided us the backup lines of credit that we ultimately drew on, as we saw originally, you know, we were unable to sell our non-conforming loans, and they were in our inventory, and we, you know, we saw the repo market to finance them mm-hmm. being disrupted. We sought to, you know, to negotiate replacement financing arrangements, asset-backed or secured financing arrangements, a different form of repo, if you will, mm-hmm. with the bank group, since the public markets, the capital markets, you know, seem to be shut down. So Countrywide, you know, very little of Countrywide's actual borrowings, if any, you know, were actual bank loans, as you would see at, you know, other companies use to finance their business. It was really, you know, it was really almost entirely, in the case of our mortgage banking business, financed with public debt. You know, whether it was medium term or short term, whether it was commercial paper or medium term notes, and the public markets, the capital markets, shut down such that, you know, we began looking for kind of a more traditional form of financing, that being traditional bank financing from our banking group, you know, who were only there as a kind of a backstop with this backup letter of credit before, and perhaps, you know, some other things that we did with them. And those were the guys we talked to.
Mm-hmm. And they, I mean, they had the backup line, so go ahead.
Yeah, so we initially did not want to draw down on our backup lines. We recognized that that would be a, you know, that would be a an event that we, you know, would be a trigger for, you know, for consequences that would be, you know, that would be negative to us. And so, you know, we desired not to draw down on our lines of credit, and that in part was why we talked to them. But what we came to find is that they were having their own problems. And because they also needed to finance themselves, you know, in the capital markets, and they also had their inability to sell assets resulted in, you know, capital constraints and balance sheet limits that precluded them from making new loans. And you know, as we found out later, some of these banks, you know, had problems to the extent that they needed bailouts and so forth. But so while they, you know, were working with us, you know, and sensitive to Countrywide as a client and trying to help us, not wanting us to draw down on a line of credit, for example, because that would make them unsecured creditors of ours. You know, it would move from a commitment to an actual loan. That, you know, they had their own problems, is what we were told, and we determined that they were not going to be a solution for us, you know, as we had hoped initially. And that was one of the determinations that were made in the first, you know, couple of weeks from the commencement of the crisis to when we drew down on the line of credit.
What about any discussions with the Fed? We've seen some, maybe even you talked about it in the third quarter 07 conference call. But if not, I know I've seen it in other documents that there was some efforts to go to the Fed and get financing. Were you involved in that at all?
And by the way, that's what I was stepping in. This has been sort of a hot button issue in some litigation about the privilege attaching to the regulators. And I don't know what position the company's taking in this setting, but I just want to.
He knows where the line is. So
okay, so I'll just follow your
lead. Okay, though. You're not at liberty without the specific permission of the bank regulators to discuss specific conversations you had with them, because they view that as falling within the bank supervisory privilege.
Yeah, I didn't have any conversations with the Fed myself, but, you know, to the extent we had our Treasury Department or our bank or, you know, different areas of the company talking to different, you know, counterparties, you know, I would be debriefed on what was, you know, the discussions and, you know, what progress or lack of progress, you know, what was being made. And I know that we did talk to the Fed, you know, in their capacity as a lender to banks.
And what did you learn during the debriefings?
You know, that the Fed was not, you know, I can't recall the specifics. I think it was something related to their discount window. But the Fed was not, forthcoming with additional financing at the time. You know, they wanted to understand the situation. I think they were interested in understanding, you know, whether there were systemic issues in the market, things like that. But in terms of you know, whether they were going to actually extend financing to us, I don't think that they did. But you know what? It's my recollection is hazy. It might be that they actually were ready to, or were talking to them about doing something, but then we but at some point, but then we determined that we had an alternative that was superior. But I my recollection is hazy on what happened with the Fed. Other than that, we were in communication, and initially it was a lengthy process.
Okay, what was your involvement, if any, in the negotiations that led to the $2 billion B of A investment and then ultimately the acquisition?
Very little in the negotiations. I think we discussed, after we pulled or drew down on our lines of credit, our immediate liquidity needs, were addressed. We were hopeful that the infusion of a significant amount of cash, plus our plans to move our business to into the bank and use the bank to finance our business going forward, which is a plan we'd otherwise had, in place, that was scheduled for, completion sometime in 08, needed to be accelerated. The banking regulators were, at that time, the people from the OTS were very supportive in helping us accelerate that. And we felt that, with all that, we could just kind of work our way through the crisis, and that, we're hopeful that, this freeze in the market would eventually thaw. And while, certainly, certain types of loans might not be doable going forward, again, that was not very consequential to us, because we actually thought we might be a beneficiary of it all. The market was going to consolidate. We were going to be one of the winners. We would continue to act as a mortgage banker and originate that which, was saleable, which, the U.S. mortgage market was still a huge market. I mean, it still, needed to finance $2-3 trillion of housing every year, and we were, we were in a good position, but we just needed to work through, kind of that that environment. But then, as we saw later with other participants in the market, there was an issue of uncertainty and confidence, and reporters, and articles, and people were. We had deposit outflow from the bank, and things started happening that, little brush fires and because of fear and uncertainty. And we realized that, without regard to, again, the fundamentals of the business and what we had, the plan that we had, and the fact that we felt that we had stabilized and made all the moves that we should make, our fate was going to be impacted by perception and confidence, and we started thinking about what can we do additionally to inspire some confidence, and we talked as a senior management team, and Angela and I talked about, and I'm not sure what the catalyst was, but perhaps getting an investment from a very brand, like a prestigious brand name, that by virtue of that investment, more so than our need for the money, because we felt we were okay liquidity-wise and capital-wise at the time, but just the gesture we thought would be a confidence-inspiring gesture, and that's what. And then there was one of our advisors was close to B of A, and he put us together, and that's how that came about. But the actual negotiations of that investment, I really had very little to do with.
Okay, there has at least been reports in the financial press, and maybe I've seen it in non-public documents too, that B of A, there was questions about B of A backing out of the deal after the deal was announced in either late 07 or early 08, doesn't close until July, and obviously they didn't back out. Any knowledge about that?
They never suggested to us that they were thinking of backing out. We sold the company, we had a tight deal, they got a they bought the company at what we felt was a good price for them. Provided cushions and from the time when we were talking about the deal to acquire the company, not the $2 billion investment. From the time that we announced to the time of the deal, you know, as far as I was concerned, we were working to closing, and they never suggested that there was any, you know, scenario where closing wouldn't occur.
Let me close out the liquidity part of this, okay, and then we'll get done. I know you have a hard stop. Is it noon already?
Yeah.
Time flies when I'm having fun. So were there ever any discussions within Countrywide about filing for bankruptcy? In your opinion, could Countrywide have survived without the B of A acquisition?
Well, at the time, I thought that we could. My opinion at the time was that I felt that you know, we could, but I was concerned about, you know, these uncertainties and, you know, matters of confidence and the press and the depositors and things like that. And so... But I did believe that we, you know, if we didn't have the B of A deal, that we would survive.
Okay. I know you left approximately a month after the deal closed. Do you recall any discussions or hearing about whether or not B of A was asking the government for assistance related to the acquisition of Countrywide?
No, I don't. I'm not aware of that.
And do you recall, it's a similar question, if you ever hear of whether or not B of A was asking for assistance in terms of, like, capital forbearance?
No, I'm not aware of that.
My last question for you is a question I ask every senior executive from a company that was in the industry. What are your opinions on the causes of the financial crisis?
Yeah, the primary reason was what happened to home prices. That had home prices, and nobody anticipated the extent of drop in real estate prices that actually occurred. Nobody had seen anything like that historically since the Great Depression. And that was the main factor contributed to the crisis.
Anything else other than understanding that's the main factor? Anything else you see as a contributing cause?
I have a lot of thoughts, you know, but on that. But that's the main one.
Okay. Given that we're at noon, I will stop now, Mr. Samble. Thank you very much for your time.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.